This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, you that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
For weeks, Western Australia's fishing community has been protesting. Many warning they're about to lose their livelihood, saying they're tired of nobody listening. It's over a huge fishing ban that came into force this year. So what is it about? And can fishers expect a bit of relief anytime soon? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to hear from those against this fishing ban and also those who support it.
We want to be able to go out there in 10 years, 20 years. I want to take my kids and grandkids out and, you know, have a chance of catching, a real big fish.
Yeah, if you've got big thoughts on this, I'd love to hear from you. Also coming up, the realities of flying with a disability. We speak with passengers saying they're forking out way too much or they're often left stranded because airlines are not keeping up. That is coming up soon. First, though.
This is Hack.
Whether you're a Pauline Hanson supporter or not, there is right and wrong, and that is the wrong thing to say.
On Triple J.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good news for Pauline Hanson recently, with her party One Nation riding high in a string of opinion polls. That's been making so many headlines. But today, Senator Hanson is facing widespread condemnation, even from those normally aligned with her, distancing themselves from some controversial comments. She said in an interview this week, there are no good Muslims. Now, she's sort of apologised for the comment, but not fully. And as Hack political reporter Evelyn Manfield explains, it comes at a time when there's a lot of talk about immigration and a rise in Islamophobia.
This statement from Pauline was divisive, inflammatory. It's un-Australian, totally un-Australian.
To make that sort of claim, I think, is offensive on many levels.
I doubt she's ever really engaged with Muslims.
One Nation leader Pauline Hanson is copping backlash from all directions right now for saying this on Sky News on Monday.
I tell you what, I've got no time for the radical Islam. Their religion concerns me because what it says in the Quran, they hate Westerners, and that's what it's all about.
Then she went further.
You know, you say, oh, well, there's good Muslims out there. Well, I'm sorry. How can you tell me there are good Muslims?
Since then, the criticism's been widespread, including from the Imams Council.
To be frank, I don't see her as a leader. She's not acting in Australia's interest. If she was, she would be talking about the domestic abuse epidemic. She'd be talking about the many young people who are struggling with the cost of living, but she's not.
Conservatives like Nationals Senator Matt Canavan have also lined up to condemn her.
She's not fit to lead a major political party with these types of ill-disciplined statements that she won't correct. We just had a Muslim Australian, Ahmed Alam Ahmed, save lives at Bondi. He was a Muslim Australian, an Australian hero.
Along with government MP Ed Husic, who's also Muslim.
Senator Hanson's been the queen of the xenophobic scapegoating rodeo for entire time of being in politics.
Her fellow One Nation member, Barnaby Joyce, wouldn't back the comments either.
I'm not going to say that I don't have people who are friends of the Islamic faith. Mm. I do.
According to a bunch of recent opinion polls, Pauline Hanson and her One Nation party have literally never been this popular. So in the eye of the storm, what's she had to say? On ABC News Breakfast this morning, Pauline Hanson was asked to clarify.
What is your view on Australian Muslims? Do you genuinely believe there are no good Muslims in Australia?
No, I don't genuinely believe that because one woman stood for me. She was a Muslim, not a practising Muslim.
So was there an apology too? Well, sort of.
If I've offended anyone out there that doesn't believe in Sharia law or multiple marriages or wants to bring the ISIS brides in or people from Gaza who believes in the caliphate and all the rest of it, then I apologise to you for my comment. But in general, that's what they want.
And then there was this, a repeat of a call for fewer immigrants.
I'm not going to apologise for the fact is I will have my say now before it's too late. I'm at the end of my life. I'm worried about the future of this nation.
The newest comments from Pauline Hanson this week were made in an interview about the group of Australian families with links to Islamic State fighters who were trapped in Syria. More broadly, though, there is a lot of talk about immigration policy and expected to keep coming.
Our borders have been open to people who hate our way of life.
Angus Taylor's been saying it'll be a big focus of his as he settles in as the new opposition leader.
Hack on Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there. And if you are Muslim, I'm keen to hear what you think of Senator Hanson's comments. 0439 757 555. Because all of this does come on the first day of Ramadan. So it's, you know, a really busy time, a time when a lot of Muslims are thinking about a lot of things, especially with one Sydney mosque saying it's receiving threats at the moment. So let's get into this more now with someone who knows a bit about that. Yasmeen Shadid from the Lebanese Muslim Association. She's with me now in studio. Yasmeen, thank you so much for coming in. How have these comments from Pauline Hanson made you feel?
It was definitely a shocking thing that she's just said. And especially when a public figure like her says something like this, it really impacts the community a lot, especially because you are basing an ideology around almost 2 billion people. And I think the impact is really real. And it really tells us as Muslim Australians that no matter what we do and no matter how much we contribute, we will still be seen as less Australian. You know, a lot of Muslims are doctors, a lot of Muslims are teachers. We've made a real impact to society. So when you say the comment that there are no good Muslims, how? Why?
Yeah. I mean, Pauline Hanson is obviously the leader of One Nation political party, and we know at the moment they're experiencing a big spike in popularity. They're polling higher than other major parties in Australia right now. Are you worried about what that increase in popularity could mean for Islamophobia in Australia?
Definitely. And I think as well the concept hate doesn't grow in silence, right? So when a public figure, as I mentioned, like Pauline, speaks about Muslims, there will be a rise in popularity for One Nation. And we can see that now. We've gotten three letters to our Lakemba Mosque, threats, literal threats. And this is not a misunderstanding. This is a pattern we can see. As Pauline makes these comments, these threats are getting worse and worse and worse. So definitely it is a huge impact on our community. And I think Pauline right now, she needs to stop adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the threats to Lakemba Mosque. For people who aren't aware, Lakemba Mosque is in Sydney. It's one of the most well-known mosques in the country. And there has been reporting that, you know, the mosque has received threats recently. How is the mood there at the moment? Yasmeen.
It's really scary. We've had multiple calls saying that we don't feel safe coming to the mosque. We don't want to bring our children. We don't want to actually attend the mosque prayer. Why? Because we are scared that something will happen to us in our prayer, particularly given the current tensions, as we can see, a lot of parents do not want to bring their children. And no community should ever feel unsafe to practice freely their religion.
So there's lots of, you know, added security, I would guess.
Yes. So what's happening? Lakemba Mosque, we are having more police force around us, which is very good and are very, very thankful for that. Currently, we've been having ongoing contact with New South Wales Police and acknowledging that their advice that their patrol will also be at Lakemba Mosque. So every single night during the Taraweeh prayer, which is the prayer after after we break our fast, and especially with the repeated threats, we are also urging for authorities to prioritise identifying and apprehending the person responsible, as this matter is very urgent.
Yeah.
Very urgent.
I can imagine a lot of people are feeling pretty anxious right now, especially at this time. As I said, Ramadan begins tonight.
Yeah.
How are you feeling heading into Ramadan this year?
Very worried. As someone who is working at the Lebanese Muslim Association, as someone who is also working during the night at the Taraweeh prayers, I feel I have a big responsibility to protect my community. And I know that that shouldn't be my position as someone so young to be standing and protecting our community. I'm really scared, I'll be honest with you, but I really hope that police enforcement, everyone will support us and protect us during our nightly prayers because, you know, at the end of the day, Muslims, we only want to do one thing. We want to worship our God. And we are good people. We give charity. We pray. We are a religion of peace.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us about this. Yasmeen Shadid from the Lebanese Muslim Association, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And we're hearing from a lot of people on the text line. Someone says Muslims are part of the fabric of this country. Those that do not accept this are outdated and uneducated. Another person, Vian, says, so does Pauline Hanson get arrested for hate speech under the new laws? That person says, Aliana on Hack's Instagram says, as a Muslim, I don't give a shit about people like Pauline. Let her hate consume her soul. We don't have hate or anger for people like her. We have Ramadan coming and that is glorious. And someone else says, I bet anyone who agrees with her has never known a Muslim in their lives. Hack.
It is extremely frustrating to navigate the world with my disabilities. Let's talk about it.
On Triple J.
If you've ever had a delayed flight or ever had to rush to make a connection, you know how stressful flying can be. If you've got a disability, you know that that experience can take the stress to a whole other level. You might not even be able to fly at all. Maybe you're stranded somewhere. You thought you'd be able to catch a flight. At the last minute, you find out you can't. If you've experienced anything like this, I'm keen to hear from you. Message in 0439 757 555. Because you're about to meet a young sports person from Tasmania who dreams of competing in the Paralympics one day, but struggles to get interstate because of how inaccessible flying can be. Ashley Barraclough has the story.
Oh, that's better.
I love the strategy that's involved in the game. It's like a chess game, but with balls.
Rowan Easley's 22 and he's playing a sport called boccia. It's kind of like bocce or lawn bowls. We're catching up in Deloraine in the north of Tasmania, and Rowan's not just playing for fun.
I have made some very good friends here at Interstate, as the boccia community are very welcoming. Then I realised I can actually be competitive.
Rowan lives with cerebral palsy and he uses a communication device to help him talk. In boccia, he's already placing in national titles, but one day he'd like to go further.
I am working hard so I can represent Australia at international competition. Then you can be selected to play at the Olympics. My ultimate goal is the Brisbane Paralympics.
Most competitions for boccia are on the mainland, so Rowan needs to catch planes. He says Jetstar's his only option because Qantas and Virgin planes in Tassie can't fit his wheelchair. But there's another issue. Jetstar only allows two people who need wheelchair assistance per flight.
This policy really limits my flight options, requiring me to fly a day earlier or later at times.
It got complicated one time when Rowan was travelling with other Tasmanian boccia players to an interstate competition, and three of them used wheelchairs.
The only way we avoided one team member being left behind was I said I would walk off the plane down the stairs in Launceston, which I can do with two people helping me, but is not very safe. But I really did not want one of the Tassie team left behind.
Jetstar acknowledges it does have more work to do to improve accessibility, but says it can't provide the same level of help as full-service airlines because of its tighter turnaround times and different infrastructure arrangements. But Rowan's issues don't end there. Because he needs to book his flights super early to secure a wheelchair spot, sometimes the support worker booked to travel with him just can't come anymore. Twice now, Jetstar staff have refused to provide a free name change, violating the company's own policy. Jetstar later apologised and provided a refund and voucher, saying it would remind contact centre staff of the policy. Vice President of People with Disability Australia, Jared Sandell-Hay, reckons that sort of thing happens a lot.
Our members tell us all the time how frustrating and how inaccessible air travel can be.
The federal government's creating new aviation disability standards with consultation happening this year. The airline industry is warning there are genuine practical and safety issues that'll need to be worked through. Graham Samuel from the Airlines Industry Group says, for example, some wheelchairs can't go on planes because they contain lithium-ion batteries which can't be stored in the cargo hold.
You can't have a situation where that mobility appliance is loaded into the hold with a lithium battery and with the inherent risks associated with an explosion or fire. So they're the sort of things that need to be dealt with in a very practical way.
He says working through these issues will take conversations between airlines, airports and people with disability.
And we're working now with all the relevant stakeholders to actually get to an outcome which is sensible, but importantly, makes travel accessible for everyone.
Back in Deloraine, Rowan says he'd love to see people being allowed to board a plane in their own wheelchairs.
For many wheelchair users, their chair is not luggage or a luxury. It is literally their legs, their only way to get around independently.
But until that happens, he wants wheelchair users to have the same opportunities as other travellers.
I would like wheelchair users to be afforded the same opportunity with flight selection as a member of the general public, not being restricted in the type of plane we can fly on, or limited to less than 1% of available seat.
Hack on Triple J.
Ashley Barraclough reporting there and getting a lot of messages from people who've had experiences in this area. Someone says, my boyfriend just broke both of his ankles in Scotland. He was actually treated like a king flying back to Australia. Well, I must say that is probably one of the rare exceptions, because we've got a lot of other people here saying they have had really negative experiences. Someone says, I was once accused of being rude and told I wasn't paying attention when I asked multiple times for the people at the help desk to speak louder. I'm deaf in one ear and have poor hearing in the other. I was stressed and I burst into tears. Yeah, I can imagine how stressful that would be. Another person says, wheelchair accessible travel would be better if we had fast trains in Australia. That is interesting, considering some of the talk about high-speed rail that I've been seeing over the past few days. Maybe some hints from the Prime Minister that one day there could be an announcement about fast trains. Who knows? All right, we're going to move on.
Hack.
The disrespectful and borderline malicious way we've been treated has led us to now be in real financial hardship with no fish left to sell.
On Triple J.
Since the start of this year, a lot of fishers in Western Australia have been blocked from going out on the water. A massive ban put in place off the WA coast from Kalbarri in the Midwest all the way down to Esperance on the south coast. As part of this ban, the WA government also stumped up $20 million in transition support. But the industry is saying it was blindsided by the ban and the support is nowhere near enough. There have been protests, people taking to the streets, bailing up politicians, one person even climbing a roof in protest. I'm interested, if you are a fisher, maybe in WA or maybe in another part of the country, what do you think of this ban? Are you affected by something similar where you are? Message in 0439 757 555. It's definitely got a lot of people heated. There are some big thoughts on this. And today, experts were meeting in Perth to talk about the consequences of a ban like this, why it's needed. And there was debate on both sides. In a bit, we're going to talk through the science here, speak to an expert. But first, Jackson Worthington has the latest from Perth.
I'm on top of the two-storey building, fisheries building, chained myself up in protest. I won't be coming down until Jack Jarvis gives me a call and gives my shark license back.
It's been a big week for Geraldton shark fisher John Hyam.
What have you locked yourself with?
Chain and padlock.
On Monday, he popped up on ABC Radio in regional WA saying he was on the roof at the Primary Industries Department office chained to an antenna.
Who's got the key?
I swallowed them, so they ain't coming out anytime soon.
So what's happening here? John was protesting a ban on demersal fishing that came in WA last month. The ban prevents recreational and commercial fishers from catching species like snapper or jewfish in an area that runs from Kalbarri, 6 hours north of Perth, to Augusta, 7.5 hours south of the city. It includes all the sea off Perth too. The recreational ban is in place until September 2027. The commercial ban is permanent. People like John are caught up in it because shark fishing results in some demersal bycatch.
I've got no compensation. No one's rung me. I've had nothing.
The WA government have announced a $20 million transition plan to support the industry, including mandatory buyback of fishing licenses and support for bait and tackle shops.
I've been living off savings, and savings are starting to run out, and now it's starting to get really desperate.
John's not the only one protesting. In January, a convoy of fishers caused traffic disruption in Perth when they drove through with their boats attached, and a petition for an inquiry has gained 34,000 signatures and will be tabled next week. Kiralee Waugh is the opposition fishery spokesperson.
The welfare of those fishers that had their livelihoods taken away overnight, it's just not good enough.
I mean, I've been fishing my whole life with my dad, so, you know, ever since I was little, any time we got, every weekend sort of thing, we'd be out fishing.
Levi loves fishing. He's out on the boat most weekends. He's the vice president of the Perth Game Fishing Club, and he works for Wreckfish West.
It's a good excuse to get out, you know, in nature and with your friends and family and have a laugh. And for me, it's more so about just that time away from life and getting out into the environment. And
Levi supports the temporary ban on recreational fishing, but he admits the speed at which it came in was a bit of a shock.
We want to be able to go out there in 10 years, 20 years. I want to take my kids and grandkids out and, you know, have a chance of catching a real big fish.
Today, WA's Fishery Minister Jackie Jarvis was on a panel at a fishing forum at the ABC office in Perth.
The burning question to me was, how do I divide all the interests?
There was a plainclothes security detail in the crowd and cops stationed outside because the minister has had death threats and headless fish sent to her office. Jackie Jarvis says her decision to close the fishery is based on the science.
You know, we have, you know, people who want more marine parks and sanctuary zones. We have a commercial sector, we have a recreational sector. And it would be very clear to me there just wasn't enough fish for everyone.
Do you trust the science now?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
WA Fishing Industry Council CEO Melissa Haslam was also at the forum here today. She reckons commercial fishers have been singled out by the government.
It does feel like we're picking favourites amongst our citizens. Those who like to wreck fish, they should absolutely be able to wreck fish. But all of our other citizens who don't wreck fish, we shouldn't be shut out from that zone.
For her, a permanent ban isn't the answer.
If we can recover the fishery, I think we should all be able to share in our West Australian resource.
Hack on Triple J. Jackson Worthington reporting there. Look, let's get into some of the detail with an expert now, someone who knows a lot about this, who is actually on the panel at the Fishing Ban Forum in Perth today. Her name is Professor Jessica Maywig, and she's a professorial fellow at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Western Australia. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
This is a huge ban, obviously sweeping a massive part of the WA coast. The question a lot of listeners would have is this going to work? Is it going to protect fish stocks?
So the 18-month closure that the minister has put in place, and she's to be commended for her courage, is a really good opportunity to take a breath. But opening the fishery back up to the recreational sector in 18, 21 months is not going to solve the problem. They're just going to have really, really good fishing. So part of this period of time that we have is we need to look at proper closures that are permanent in key areas for geofish that protect them forever. Because we know that permanent closures, these are actually the engine rooms of fisheries productivity. So if we want more fish for everyone, that's what we need to do.
So in addition to a commercial ban, an indefinite recreational ban, is that what you're saying?
What we basically want is enough fish for everybody so that people can continue fishing. We can achieve that by setting some areas of our coast aside permanently protected. And that means that people can continue to fish in the other areas of the coast. We don't need to fish everywhere, but what we do need to do is put some places aside as permanently protected.
Obviously, there's a lot of anxiety around this. There's a lot of anger as well. We've seen over the past few weeks people saying they're losing their livelihoods. How do you respond to that?
With sadness, because it should never have gotten to this point. And there are people who are losing their livelihoods in the recreational sector. Campgrounds, people have just dried up because they can't come for fish. Commercial fishers are going through an uncertain process of what a buyout actually looks like. And what's sad about this is we've known for 15 years, let's say, that geofish were in trouble. And we just tinkered at the edges forever. And part of that was recreational fishers were screaming about any changes. Commercial fishers were screaming about any changes. So we never took the big decisions that we need to. And now they're in dire straits. And so the decision's tough.
Can you explain what a demersal fishing ban actually means? For people who aren't familiar with this kind of language, what kind of fish will be protected? Which species are most at risk?
Yeah, so demersal basically means things that hang out on the seabed. So in this case, the species that are of significant concern are West Australian geofish, only found in Western Australia, pink snapper, nanagai, species that are heavily associated with reefs.
Obviously, Professor Maywig, this is focused on WA and WA fishers, but there are fishing communities across the country. Do you think it's likely, or should we be seeing similar bans in other parts of Australia?
There's certainly other fisheries in Australia that are in trouble. The lesson from Western Australia is don't let it get this bad and implement the science-based solutions that we've known about for 50 years, which is marine parks. Get in on the front foot and set up these highly protected areas that become these engine rooms. And I think in particular, New South Wales has just been going backwards. You've actually been sort of opening up your marine parks to fishing, which is exactly the wrong strategy.
And do you feel like it is possible to have a really sustainable fishing industry where commercial fishers, recreational fishers can be a part of this world while we also protect fish species?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the goal, right? I like eating fish. And what we know, again, going back to that example from the Great Barrier Reef, where 80% of the coral trout are coming out of 20% of the area, that's exactly what you want. I mean, there are always limits. And as human populations increase, you know, we have to think about food security and how much food is available. But we're not going to achieve ongoing access if we don't protect stocks. And the best way to do that is through marine parks. Another great example is that of Hawaii. So the yellowfin tuna catches are just off the charts because they protected a big area. And so now the fishing's really good outside of that area. And this is exactly the model that we need to replicate, not just in Western Australia, but in Australia generally.
You know, Jessica, we often might hear about seasonal closures or partial bans, things like that. Do they actually work?
No. There's two types of marine parks. They're the ones where there's no fishing at all, highly protected. And there are ones where we still let one group fish and not another, or we only protect the seabed and not the water column, or it's only part of the year. And that kind of partial protection, it doesn't work because somebody's going to take the fish or they're just going to take it after it opens up again. And that partial protection, like, when did your sex ed teacher ever tell you that worked?
I mean, fair point, Jessica. Professor Jessica Maywig from the University of Western Australia, really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And look, we've got a lot of messages coming through, a lot of thoughts on this, as you can imagine. People calling up as well on the phone line. We've got Jack with us now. Jack, you're in Queensland. You're a fisher. How are you feeling about this ban? You're not in WA, but what are your thoughts on it?
No, I am in Queensland, but I've got a lot of mixed thoughts about the ban in WA. Yeah, I don't agree with it.
And what is it about it that you don't agree with? We just heard from an expert there who said, oh, we've got to do something, otherwise there'll be no fish for anyone. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the expert also said that they've known about this issue for a few years and did nothing about it, which surprises me. I believe that harsher quotas could have been implemented before closing down the whole fishery to everyone, because I don't know if you've seen a lot on the media or not, but it's definitely affecting a lot of people in WA at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And we're hearing from a lot of those people now. We're about to talk to another person. But just before we do that, Jack, what is it like being a young person in the fishing industry right now? Like, is it pretty tough?
At the moment in Queensland, it's not. But seeing what's happening in WA is kind of scary for everyone on the Queensland coast, because our bag limits recreationally are definitely a lot higher. And seeing what they did in WA, it's definitely scary for everyone over here, because I feel like they'd be doing the same on this side of the country in no time.
Yeah, well, look, Jack, thank you so much for having a chat with us. It's good to get a bit of an insight into how fishers are coping in other parts of the country. We've also got Steve with us, and Steve is actually in Kalbarri, one of the areas that is affected by this. Steve, how are you feeling about all this?
Yeah, hey, mate. I've got very mixed feelings about this. I actually bought the local tackle shop and took over trading the day of the announcement. An hour into trading, my first day, we were met with this. So, I've got many mixed emotions. I've been a commercial fisherman. I've been heavily involved in the industry, in the tackle industry as well, sort of in and out for a fair while, and We've known something's going to be was on the way for a long time. I mean, the science is there, and all the rest of the stuff to back up their decision. Mm-hmm. The thing that annoys me the most about it is the impacts to the multiple various industries and coastal communities up and down our state, and just at the drop of a hammer. When I honestly think there could be more of a targeted approach and more of a work with us in these industries than against us, sort of thing. And it's a bit of a hard one. There's a lot of varying opinions over here on the West Coast. There's a lot of hysteria as well getting thrown around.
We're hearing that, Steve, and people are saying, look, we do maybe agree that something needs to be done, but we just feel like we haven't been consulted widely enough. We just feel like maybe there could have been a bit more communication with fishers. Look, Steve, thank you very much for speaking with us. I do appreciate your time as well. That is all we've got time for on Hack for today.